This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I am your host, Alex Smith. Regulars may have noticed I've been a day late posting new shows at our website, ecoshock.org, or the program blog at ecoshock.info is not as full as usual. That is because I've been on the road in the United States for the past few weeks. As a person concerned about carbon emissions, I've avoided long-distance traveling since 2003. That's hard for a natural gypsy and world traveler like myself. I settled in a relatively energy-efficient condo in a progressive city of Vancouver. I used mass transit and made a once-yearly pilgrimage to a campsite in the mountains every summer. Now, I'm a carbon super sinner just like you, and I'm not totally sure why. We left the city to go back to the land in the late 1970s, living without electricity, growing most of our own food and all of our own heat. That was before we knew about climate change. Few followed that example. Again, I can see that humans are not responding even to the simple idea of minimal human living in cities. Sure, we recycle. Maybe we'd turn off a few lights, cycle, or walk more. In winter, the cities could not exist without fossil fuels in the Northern Hemisphere. In the southern U.S., where record heat came again this spring, millions depend upon air conditioning to survive. There are much better alternatives. We've covered quite a few on Radio EcoShock, like the passive house homes that need no outside heat or cooling. I'll be talking to such a home builder in Australia in a couple of weeks. Our pioneer ancestors, and especially the First Nations people, obviously lived without fossil fuels or chemical pollution, but they had much smaller cities, if any, and most folks lived in rural farms. We're not going back to that. In my latest tour, I asked Americans if they thought the climate was changing. I was unable to find a single person who doubted it. People became very alive talking about the strange weather. Many had experienced storms, droughts, floods, fires, heat waves in March, and so on, and they wanted to tell me about it. Only a few wondered if it was just a passing phase of nature. Most believed humans have triggered a change. You would never know it. From reading the local papers, which I purchased everywhere we went, I found crime stories, hatred of the poor, hatred of the government, and no inkling of a serious problem, other than reports of odd weather. I didn't see any significant signs of change in the dozen western states I visited. Twice we saw wind farms, just twice. Once I saw solar panels on a single building, once. Big cars and trucks are plentiful, while people complain bitterly about the cost of gas. The folks are worried about the economy, but not about the environment. They don't seem to see the big changes ahead for all of us. They think gas will not run out. We'll still farm as usual, buy whatever we want at the supermarket. It's too bad the river's too polluted to swim in, but really, those environmentalists have gone too far, haven't they? Making it harder to fish and hunt, making crazy rules, making us all feel guilty. That is what is out there. In southern Utah, there are natural wonders of red sandstone. The deep canyon walls of Zion, the amazing hoodoos at Bryce. All of that comes from the time about 200 million years ago when the hothouse world was encircled by tropical deserts. Eventually, the giant sand dunes, larger than anyone can imagine, hardened into stone. They were uplifted and then eroded by water. Climate scientists and those who study deep time warn we can return to those giant deserts. In fact, they are already slowly forming as the Mediterranean area dries out and their forests die and burn to become like the Sahara to the south. Scientists like Jonathan Overpeck from the University of Arizona have already warned on this program and in many papers and reports that a long-term drying has struck the U.S. Southwest. It could last hundreds of years or thousands of years. Australia also has vast areas farmed that are now drying and burning. Desertification is the curse of China. Even the Brazilian rainforest experienced two massive droughts in the last 15 years. Longtime listeners will recall Dr. James Lovelock's summary of British climate models, which predict a band of desert dry lands stretching around the globe in a few centuries as the world heats up at a record rate. All this has happened before, but never so fast, and never triggered by the actions of a single species. It's not just the climate. In a recent show, we covered the damage to plants by our industrial pollution, a chain of nitrous oxide producing low-level ozone. One of my longtime correspondents and music contributors, Dana Pearson, was discouraged. Like many, he thought we could transition a modern society using solar power and other non-fossil energies. Find Dana's music at soundclick.com or just search for Vast Mandana. I've just had a different sad report from another show volunteer, Chris Canali, who is helping improve the graphic design of our Radio EcoShock blog. With no budget at all, Radio EcoShock couldn't function without our volunteer helpers. I wrote Chris about my climate pessimism. I said, considering our utter dependence on machinery and electrons, we will likely burn everything, all the oil, all the gas, all the coal, no matter how dirty, destructive, and expensive the methods might be to get it. His reply surprised me twice. First, at the Arkansas River, where he likes to camp, swimming has been permanently banned. The culprit is not climate change. The cause is water polluted to toxic levels by agricultural runoff, you know, excess nitrogen, animal dung, pesticides, and other nasties. They can't or won't stop it. The pollution is just part of our massive confined animal feeding operation food system, CAFO. You want it at the supermarket cheap. Forget about swimming or drinking in another big river. Too bad for the other species killed off. It's another case of our systemic destruction of nature. The second surprise from Chris Canali was just as extreme. Where I found Arizona drying up on my trip, this spring Oklahoma is inundated with rain. This in a state which experienced several years of record droughts along with neighboring Texas. Sure, climate change should really be called climate disruption. Swings in rainfall should be expected, with severe precipitation events becoming the worldwide norm where rain falls. But Chris is suspicious there are other causes. He sent me the Weather Modification Annual Meeting Program Agenda, held in Las Vegas, Nevada, from April 25th to 27th, 2012. This is not about conspiracies to change the weather using the secret of HAARP antenna farms in Alaska. Nope, and we're not talking about chemtrails either. The purpose of this meeting is to discuss making rainfall in the Southwest and in other parts of the world. It's the first step of local geoengineering. These scientists, government representatives, and corporations hope to contradict the trends of climate change, or at least adapt the atmosphere to fit the needs of industrial agriculture. We hear about using aerosols, airborne particles, to add rainfall in Colorado, or, quote, low-level atmospheric stability during icing periods in Utah, and implications for winter ground-based cloud seeding. Wyoming has a pilot weather modification project. There is a quasi-attempt at regulation through the Atmospheric Water Management Standards Committee. I have no idea how much, or if any, public protection or protection for nature is built into that community. Frankly, I'll bet most of you had no idea weather modification is being employed in the U.S. in the Southwest. I didn't know. The granddaddies behind a lot of this rainmaking seem to come from Texas. You've heard how the last few years of drought, especially in 2011, killed off the range cattle industry, dried up lakes and reservoirs, and cost many billions of dollars of crop losses in this mass-producing agricultural state. Everything from rice to carrots went downhill when the rain just stopped in Texas, to be replaced by unbelievable record heat waves, not for weeks, but months. There are massive cloud seeding operations in Texas. Everything from satellites to dual polarization radar are used to measure and time things. It's a big and growing industry which fully acknowledges that the climate is changing and that drought is part of that picture. Those crazy Americans? Not really. The Las Vegas conference heard reports on weather modification in Canada, Australia, Japan, and France. You know, Russia pioneered this to some degree. China is doing it big time. They did it for the Olympics. Weather modification, that's the answer to climate change. It's called the technical fix. Like all technical fixes, there are always unforeseen consequences. Chris in Oklahoma believes their unusual spring rains are the result of Texan weather modification being a little too successful. The intended rain may be blowing into Oklahoma instead of right into Texas. Thanks for this heads up from Chris. Find his excellent graphics work at canaledesign.com, and that starts with a K.
Gradually it would dawn on people that the world has changed and it isn't going to go back to the way it was before. Some people emotionally could never make the transition to accepting this change. They would continue to hope that their previous lives would be restored, but of course they never would be.
So the boys are playing with the sky, trying to fend off what Texas refineries and all our fossil dependency will bring. I'm going to play you part of a long podcast about the problems of depending on that technical fix. It's from Justin Ritchie and Seth Mozerkatz, hosts of The Extra Environmentalist. That's episode number 37. The dynamic duo interview Michael Huseman. Huseman and his wife co-wrote the book Technofix, and it's an antidote to the whole movement of techno-optimism. At the end of this program, I'm also going to play you a slice from a long-term lefty broadcaster, David Barsamian, on what we can do. You can download his whole speech as I recorded it in Vancouver from our blog at ecoshock.info or from our website. Like myself, Barsamian is no wild optimist about our chances. Here is a teaser from the question and answer period that I recorded.
Capitalism, up until now, has shown a singular inability to act collectively on the issue of environment. So I don't know if, you know, there's any kind of socialist future. Anyone who says, who knows what's going to happen in the future, I think is guessing. But if things continue along the model that we are currently enjoying, I think the planet is doomed. And whether that's 40 years or 50 years or 60 years, by most scientific estimates, by the year 2100, life on Earth will be dramatically different from what it is right now. Again, I think collective action is required, whether that's some kind of socialist future, I don't know.
First, let's go to Arizona, the end of my journey, to hear from Dr. Michael Huseman, the research scientist, in an interview for The Extra Environmentalist. As that interview is almost 2 hours long, we'll go for some of the juicy bits about the belief that technology can save us from the death spiral of technology.
In taking the title Technofix, can you tell us why you chose that title and why technology won't save us?
A technofix is basically an attempt to solve a problem with technology by addressing only the symptoms instead of the root cause. And it's called a fix because it does not really result in long-term lasting solutions. So technofixes are attempts to solve either problems caused by previous technologies or to solve social problems. Let me give you a few examples about solving problems caused by previous technologies. Two examples. One is traffic congestion. Traffic congestion, the root cause of traffic congestion, of course, is too many cars, too many drivers, too many miles driven. And the techno fix is to build more roads. And, you know, there's always this idea, if we build more roads, traffic congestion will disappear. But it has been known for over 100 years that building more roads attracts more traffic, so it makes the problem worse. So that's a good example of a techno fix. Now, we have a whole other series of techno fixes appearing here on the horizon for climate change mitigation technologies. You know, climate change is primarily caused, as everyone knows, by fossil fuel combustion, CO2 emissions related to fossil fuel combustion. So scientists try to start thinking about how to get rid of this excess CO2. So there are these concepts of pumping the CO2 into the ground called geological carbon sequestration. The problem with this is we don't know whether it will stay in the ground, whether it can leak out. And then when it leaks out, the CO2 leaks out of the ground, whether it will have health or environmental impacts. And other scientists have come up with the concept of pumping the CO2, the excess CO2, into the deep ocean. But then we don't know what happens to the pH, whether the ocean will acidify, and what will happen to the deep sea creatures. And then even another idea is to sprinkle a little fertilizer over hundreds of square miles of ocean to stimulate phytoplankton growth. Because as soon as phytoplankton, algae, start growing, then they suck out CO2 from the air to grow, like any plant does during photosynthesis. But the question there is, again, what will happen if you have all these algae blooms all over the ocean? What will happen to the food web, the whole nutrient cycles, etc.? So we can see that technofixes have three problems. The first thing is they always have unanticipated side effects. And the second problem is they are never really providing long-term lasting solutions because they never address the root cause of the problem. And then the third problem with fixes is they cover up symptoms and often make problems worse. And so that's why technofixes are a bad idea.
What are the unintended consequences of technology? And do you have any examples of how these unintended consequences stack up or add up?
First, I would like to mention that unintended consequences of technology actually cannot be even avoided and cannot be predicted. So that's a pretty bad combination. Let me give you an example why environmental consequences of technologies are inevitable. The main reason is that as soon as you apply technology in a natural system, that at least three different ecological laws are violated, and by violating these laws, you have unintended consequences. And these laws have been called by Barry Commoner the laws of ecology. Barry Commoner was an activist biology professor many years ago, and he wrote a number of books on that topic. So the first law of ecology is called everything is connected to everything else. So if you apply a technology to a natural environment to manipulate the natural environment, because everything is connected to everything else, there will be unintended consequences in another part of that system. If you manipulate it in one part of the system, there will be a consequence in another part of the system. Then technology also violates the second law of ecology, which Barry Commoner called nature knows best. Nature knows best means that nature, over billions of years of evolution, has really optimized all the interactions. The interactions within this natural systems have been optimized by something called, natural research and development, if you want to call evolution natural research and development. And so, because everything has been optimized to function in a good way, if humans come in with technology to manipulate nature, they basically disturb this intricate optimized balance, and so there will be automatically negative consequences. And then the third law of ecology was called there is no such thing as free lunch, meaning that you have to pay for what you get, i.e. if you extract something from a natural environment for your benefit, for human benefit, there is a cost associated with it. There's a price to be paid. And that price is basically the environmental problems we have right now. All the problems that show up are the price that shows up, or the cost that show up in a delayed way. And one would think, well, if all these consequences cannot be avoided, at least it would be nice if scientists could be able to predict them. And the problem is the scientific method is not good enough for scientists to predict all these unintended consequences. The current scientific method, which has been around now for 200-300 years, is based on mechanistic reductionism, meaning that you can try to understand the whole by looking at isolated parts, by looking only at one cause and effect relationship at a time. Like when we do laboratory experiment, we just only vary one parameter to look what effect that has. So we look only at one cause and effect relationship. The problem is we don't look at all the other millions of other cause and effect relationships that might be out there when we start manipulating nature with technology in one area. We do not know what all the other consequences might be because our scientific method is not good enough to elucidate all these different cause and effect relationships that are out there in nature. So let me give you two examples of unintended consequences just briefly. One was from the car culture we have for over 100 years. I am sure that the people who first invented the car, the automobile, did not know that this would take off like crazy. Right now we have over 160 million cars in the United States and over 530 million worldwide. Cars have actually killed more people than World War I and II combined. 30 million humans have been killed by cars. And of course, we are all aware of the unintended environmental consequences from smog, oil spills, climate change, urban sprawl, etc. Let me give you one more example of an unintended consequences in medicine. That is antibiotic resistance. 60 years ago, penicillin was invented, and I'm sure most doctors were not aware about the problem of antibiotic resistance, and as a result of antibiotic resistance, there are more than 2 million hospital infections each year in the United States alone because of antibiotic-resistant pathogens. So we can see that even in medicine, not only in the environmental area and also in other technology-related areas, there are unintended consequences that are unpredictable and unavoidable. So that's really sort of a bad combination.
So I always hear that technology is a neutral tool and that, you know, the consequences aren't really the problem so much of the people who are experiencing the technology. It's the people who are taking the technology and using it in the wrong way. And the technology itself is just a neutral tool. What do you have to say about that?
What you are referring to here is called the myth of value neutrality, that technologies are simply neutral tools which can be used for good or evil purposes depending on who controls them. And the problem with this myth is, of course, like all myths, they are not correct, but the problem is that all technologies, particularly the technologies that are more specifically designed for a specific purpose, embody the values of the designer. Basically, the development of a technology is a creative process, and because the designer has to make choices what to include and what to exclude. And by making these choices, there are value judgments to be made. And these values are embodied in the final technology. For instance, let me give you a number of examples. It is very clear that most military technologies have a built-in bias towards violence. So they have, they basically embody the value of violent conflict resolution, if you want to call it that way. That nuclear energy, for instance, because nuclear energy, the generation of nuclear energy requires large capital, a large plant. It's very difficult for just one individual person to manage it. So it requires centralized control. And because of that, nuclear energy has an automatic bias towards centralized control. It can't be controlled in a decentralized way. And also has a bias towards environmental risk because it generates radioactive waste. Genetic engineering technologies are commodifying plants and animals. So they objectify nature. There's another hidden value there just in genetic engineering technologies. And even something simple as television has a built-in bias, or let's call it promotes individualism and consumerism. So because people sit by themselves watching the screen, the same applies to a computer screen also, but let's talk about TV. They basically interact with the TV screen by themselves as individuals. So just the TV technology, the television technology, has a built-in bias towards individualism. And why is this really a problem? I mean, should we be worried about that technologies embody values? Well, the problem is, as soon as technologies get diffused through society on a large scale, like 99% of US households now have televisions, and 95%, I think, watch them regularly for 5 hours per day. So if you have massive diffusion of a technology throughout society, then suddenly the values get transferred into the society, and the society adapts those values and gets influenced by it. For instance, like with TV, the community life is weakened because if everybody or almost everybody watches 5 hours per day television as an individual in front of the TV, then there's less time for social interactions. And the same can be also seen with technology transfer to third world nations. As soon as you transfer technology like television, cell phones, computer technology to third world nations, suddenly their whole culture changes in a completely unanticipated way. At least those people are very surprised about it, but it's really not surprising because the technology embodies the values of those who designed them. And so that's why I at least believe that it is dangerous to believe that technology is value neutral.
I was reading the other day in Time magazine, it was an article talking about this group called the Breakthrough Institute, and it's a guy named Nordhaus is one of the people heading it up. And he was saying that because of the challenges that we're facing in our world today, we don't have any other option to develop technology in no way that we've ever done before and to accelerate innovation, and because we needed the help of technology as fast as possible. What would you say to someone like that?
I agree that innovation, particularly technological innovation, is necessary to solve our environmental and social problems. The only problem is that most technological innovation today is used for two overarching purposes. That means building better weapons or improved consumer products to increase profits of corporations. So I believe that as long as technological innovation is focused on maximizing profit and stimulating economic growth, environmental problems are unlikely to be solved. If technological innovation, however, is applied within a new framework of a steady state economy, it has great potential to solve environmental problems. Let me explain what I mean by a steady state economy. A steady state economy is a no-growth economy where there is zero growth, which means that material affluence per capita GDP, gross domestic product, and population size both stay more or less constant. So this is different from today where both affluence is increasing and also population size is increasing. So we need to apply technological innovation within the framework of a steady state economy. Let me give you an example why it doesn't work otherwise. If you still have a growth economy, why technological innovation will not necessarily work. For instance, a lot of engineering innovation has been used to build more energy efficient cars. There will only be a reduction of energy use if there's no increase in the total number of miles people drive worldwide. If there's continuous growth in driving, in more driving, more drivers, more distance driven, if you build more energy efficient cars, it will not make much of a dent in the total fuel or gasoline or diesel, whatever fuel used. And this is actually confirmed by the data. They did some studies and they found out that from 1974 to 1998, there was an increase in fuel efficiency in industrialized countries by 20%. So cars became 20% more fuel efficient between 1974 and 1998, but total fuel consumption increased nevertheless by 40%. And why? Because people started driving much more, had more cars and drove longer distances by 75%. So this clearly shows that if we want to protect the environment with technological innovation, we first have to transition to a steady state economy to eliminate growth, to have a steady state economy, and then apply technological innovation to reduce resource use and pollution.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to an interview of Dr. Michael Huseman of Arizona by Seth Moser-Katz and Justin Ritchie. They are the hosts of the podcast called The Extra Environmentalist. These excerpts on the risks of techno-optimism come from episode number 37, available in full at theextraenvironmentalist.com. More from Michael Huseman on the TechnoFix, plus a recording of counterculture journalist David Barsamian as Radio EcoShock continues.